The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So before I offer this last talk on the theme of the week, self, mindful of oneself, ourselves, there's a couple of announcements. One is that I thought at the end of today at 7:45 here in California that I could stay here on YouTube for a while, and if you have any questions you'd like to make around what I've been teaching or something else, I could take for a while. We can just do a little Q&A session, and I'll talk a little bit about how we'll do that at the end. And I apologize for a few weeks ago that I used the wrong Zoom account for us here on Fridays to have a community meeting after one of these sessions, and we'll do one next time I'm here, maybe on a Friday, maybe. I'll be gone for the next two weeks, taking a vacation. And next week, Nikki Murgafori will be back, and the following week, Diana Clark will be back. Wonderful teachers here at IMC. And in terms of community meetings, we're going to have a community meeting for the Sunday morning group on Zoom this Sunday at after the Sunday morning Dharma talk. So if some of you like to join and if it's kind of be more connected to this IMC community, you could come then on Sunday. That the meeting's at 10:30, and the information is on the calendar for Sunday morning. So, this question of what is the self, who are we, is a very profound question and a very rich question that is multifaceted and doesn't lend itself, especially in the English-speaking world, to a singular idea, a singular concept even of what self is. I think psychologists, neuropsychologists, people have been looking for, philosophers have been looking for this self. What is the self, and trying to define it? And it's to a great extent, people keep coming back that it's very hard to define. And perhaps lots of modern researchers are coming up with the Buddhist idea that there is no self. Rather, what we are is a conglomeration of many different mental forces that operate, and physical and mental forces that operate, that have some way in which they get put together in some feeling of unified self or central self or something. But that to really investigate deeply and really kind of explore what that is, it begins to unravel and begins to show itself as being made up of many different subparts that are arising and passing, impermanent, changing, and flux. And so there are some modern researchers who will say such things as there is no self inherently. The Buddha didn't say that explicitly. He didn't say there is no self. In fact, as I quoted earlier, he thought that was actually a quagmire, a kind of quicksand to kind of go into that notion that there is no self. But he did say that there are ideas of self, there are doctrines of self, there are philosophies of self that exists. And he said that any doctrine of self, any philosophy of self, will involve some degree of suffering. There's something about the coming together and holding something, a view, an idea, this is what self is, that makes it very difficult to really be completely free and open and with infinite possibilities and allow for the full range of what our psychophysical functioning might be like. So in this regard, I think of kind of a little bit as a metaphor, maybe a slightly humorous metaphor, maybe. One definition I have for self is that self is wind drag. You put your, you know, you have a lot of wind drag when something's moving down, you're going on the bike, biking along, it'll slow you down. So it, self is what slows us down. And or self is a coagulation, something that's fluid, and then it becomes solid as it coagulates. And so the fluidity of who we are and how we function gets somehow solidified and tightened into something. And that tightening or that coagulation into something called self can feel like this is really something here. After all, it feels solid or it feels central, it feels well localized. But it turns out when in mindfulness practice, if we go in and look more deeply, we find that that thing, that anything that we identify or hold on to self, is actually made up of subparticles, subcomponents, and that are fluid and dynamic, and it kind of breaks down the idea of any kind of solid idea, central idea or essential idea. This is who I am. And but the Buddha never wanted to go say there is no self, because that itself is a kind of coagulation. That itself becomes an idea that we hold ourselves by. And what the Buddha was looking for was a freedom from suffering. And so this freedom is the, you know, that's what's being looked for. That's what's being championed. And the goal to that in doing vipassana practice, insight meditation, involves having three insights. And what these insights are understood to be are aspects of characteristics of our experience. So they're characteristics as opposed to things themselves. They characterize our experience. And those three insights are not biographical. So they're not considered personal insights that are only true for yourself. Those are very valuable to understand something, how you would tick and what happened to us early in life and what our personal beliefs are and how that influences our way of living. That's part of the value of mindfulness, is to highlight that. But the insight of insight meditation is not personal in nature, but rather it's understanding the building blocks for all experience, building blocks of what we call personal experience. And so it's to see something universal, something that's universally true for all human beings. And that is that all experiences we have are somehow characterized by being inconstant, as being dukkha, stressful, suffering, unsatisfactory, characterized in some way, and all experiences are not self. So whatever we actually experience, if you look deeply at it, that experience, we say, well, that's not really the self. That's not really the self. And so the more we go into our direct experience with strong mindfulness practice, we start having this insight that, oh, this is not self. This is not self. So not self is not a belief that we have to believe. It's not a philosophy. You don't have to hear the teaching of not self and then try to make yourself believe it or argue with it because it doesn't make sense. That's not really the point of it. It's not philosophy. It's not something to believe. But rather, it's something to see, something that's revealed in the course of time as mindfulness becomes strong. When mindfulness is really strong, concentration is strong, then it becomes clear that our experience we have in the experiences, well, this is not self. This is not self. And I emphasize this wording of it to make a point. When I say this is not self, it's always about this. It's always about something particular. It turns out in deep meditation practice that all the different things that can be called a direct particular experience that's used as the building blocks for conceptual understandings of who we are and what life is, all the individual building blocks of direct experience, we see very clearly, oh, that's not self. There's no, we don't plan it, we don't intend it, it just kind of arises without any will or planning or any association with any central control tower or central authority or place of being. And even, you know, one of the most powerful places of personal freedom is around personal choice. And some people want to say the ability to choose affirms that there is a self. So that's a philosophy or an idea that comes out of, even seemingly comes out of experience. But the in deep meditation, it's quite fascinating when the mind is really quiet and really sees what's arising in the mind, that even this idea of choice doesn't quite seem to be personal, doesn't quite seem to be this is who I am. Is there really choice if the choice is happening kind of without what you think is self choosing? So it gets kind of fascinating, this whole world. But we don't get lost in it when we're doing deep meditation practice, which is really where the not-self teaching really comes alive. Because that's just kind of wind drag. That's just kind of getting caught up in ideas. And what becomes clearer and clearer is that this experience, this is not self, reveals tremendous freedom. Freedom from selfing. Freedom from the attachments that are so often associated with self. And to experience this is not self in this deep revelatory way, then we can look around and nothing in our experience in that moment, no self is found. And some people will say they're having a no-self experience. And that's completely appropriate to call it that in a sense, but it's a little bit abstract. And what's dangerous is to come out of that deep meditation and come to the conclusion, kind of like a philosophy, there is no self. The Buddha didn't say that. And it kind of lends itself to all kinds of philosophical and personal difficulties if we start saying there is no self. We don't say there is a self, but there is personal responsibility. There is personal self-awareness, personal awareness, I might want to say. There is personal choice at a different level of how the mind operates and how it sees. But to really have experienced this not-self insight means that we come back from that experience much less inclined to get attached, much less inclined to be involved in greed, hate, and delusion, and much more inclined to have a clear sense, a feel for liberation, for freedom, for the emptiness of self. And that emptiness of self, that sense of lack of self as an experience, to step into that emptiness, to relax and open to that possibility that we don't have to always be measuring and thinking and feeling and deciding about things, about self, that we can step through that, into that emptiness. And the tradition calls it the door of emptiness. And that door, step through that door, allows for some of the deepest letting go that's possible. And that's called liberation and freedom. And we come out of that experience appreciating that generally this the idea of self that is so important for many people, generally it's a bit overrated. And we're much better off not to give it such a high priority and obsession that often our culture really supports us to have. That freedom from self doesn't mean that we have to kind of discard everything that we might call self, because, as I said, there's many different viewpoints of what this self is. But we can hold it all lightly, wisely, and ethically, without kind of operating with a self that is devoted or committed to greed, hatred, and delusion, to attachments. So that is my attempt to talk about this topic of self and not self. I hope it was clarifying over these days. And I'll be back here in a couple of weeks. I've been kind of doing a series now on mindfulness, you know, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of thinking, mindfulness of emotions, mindfulness of the body, and now mindfulness of self here. And I thought that when I come back, it might be interesting to do a week on mindfulness of Nibbana, mindfulness of Nirvana, of liberation itself. And that might be interesting, 5 days. So that's what I'm hoping. So thank you very much. And as I said, now I can stay here a little bit, and if you want to ask some questions in the chat. And I'm going to treat the chat as a basket that you drop your questions into, and just kind of pull them out randomly. In the past, I've tried to read them in order, because just out of, you know, respect for each one. But I think that it proves too hard with all the chats, and it moves so quickly and moving between them. So I'll try to go, you know, go around and get them, but please allow me to just let it be a basket that I pull the questions out of. How do you sit selflessly with pain and bodily malfunction? Yes, it's actually easier to sit with pain and bodily misfunction if there's not a lot of selfing going on. I learned that one of my first lessons when I started sitting retreats. I was doing Zen retreats, and you weren't allowed to move during the 45-minute sitting, and when I was sitting repeatedly through the day that way, I had a tremendous amount of knee pain, and I wasn't really limber enough and stuff. And I could see that I was very clear at some point that if I had self-pity, I think the little micro muscles around the knees got tighter and the pain got worse. And if I had no self-pity, it was easier to be with the pain. So self is often a magnet for fears, a magnet for judgments, comparisons, ideas, what should and shouldn't be. The self is not an innocent kind of little thing that's just sitting quietly and just watching what's going on. The self is a lot to do with reactivity. And it's often the seat, the house of reactivity. And so if we're really caught up in this notion of self, then pain and bodily malfunction can be a lot more difficult. If there's less self, less need to be a particular kind of self and to always measure ourselves as this is the kind of self I need to be, then it can be easier to be with pain. It's not, you know, a breeze to be with pain. I want to respect the difficulty of it. But it actually can be a lot easier if we're not doing a lot of selfing around it. If reincarnation in karma, something continues ongoing in this conglomerate. Yes. The Buddhists don't tend to use the word reincarnation. They use the word rebirth. I think because reincarnation for Buddhists suggests that there's something that's really specific that travels between one birth and the other. Rebirth, for Buddhists at least, is supposed to be the idea that there is no thing that travels, but rather it's a momentum, kind of like a wave that goes across an ocean. The wave doesn't actually, there's no water that travels with the wave, you know, across the ocean. The wave is the momentum that's pushing, like billiard balls, pushing these particles of water up and down. And so it's the up and downness, the momentum that goes across the ocean. And so Buddhists are a little bit that way more about rebirth. And the karma is the momentum, what creates that momentum is the idea. But it's a little bit hard to understand. I mean, Buddhists don't, I never felt that Buddhists really explain very well what the mechanism of rebirth is and how it really fits with this teaching of not-self. But maybe the teaching of not-self wasn't meant to explain too many things. We're philosophers, human beings often, so we're always trying to explain things and make things line up in an explanatory way. And perhaps this freedom that the Buddhism is looking for doesn't need everything explained. And so we discover this door of not-self for the purpose of freedom. We don't have to use that experience of not-self then to build explanations about how things work. Does the ego fight one to achieve freedom, or does it diminish as time goes on, or rear its head again and again? The ego. I think the attachment to self, the self-definitions we have, I think that the desires we have, the aversions we have, lends itself to a lot of impatience, a lot of restlessness, a lot of attachment to have things being a certain way. And so anything that threatens those attachments, threaten those ideas of self that we hold on to, then there's a rebellion, there's a protest, there's running away, there's frustration, there's, there can be anger, there can be all kinds of things. And sometimes there can be fantasy that we go into. And they can be very convincing. And so there are ways in which we get tricked out of the path of liberation because of, maybe what we call the ego. And so we have to be very attentive and alert to really see how all this works in our minds. And that's one of the benefits of developing mindfulness. As we get more and more clear, we see more clearly what's really going on in there. And so we're wiser about it and freer about it. Would you speak more about respect? It seems very conditional to me. I understand self-pride, vanity, compassion, love, and care, but have a hard time understanding self-respect. Quicksand or labyrinth of challenges when we start using the word self. People have so many different references for it, understandings of it, philosophies of it, and different cultures maybe even have different understanding and use that word differently. So there are some people who say that, there's a tendency sometimes in Buddhism to be very shy of using the word self, so self-respect. But that's why the talk I gave on Monday was to emphasize that the personhood, who we are, that there's something here that we become a person of respect. We become someone with a certain dignity and value. We are valuable beings, but because of the word self, it's a magnet for all this luggage, all these cultural, personal, familial ideas of what a self should be, what it is, what the right self is, the wrong self is. So it's a kind of a very complicated word. But to use it, some of these words very lightly, self-respect is the ability to be present, to see clearly, be present without disrespect, without animosity, demeaning, criticism, feeling that we're inadequate somehow. It's the ability to be present in a clear and dignified way without any diminishing of the value of who we are. That's kind of my definition of it. So I hope that was, useful. After being free of self, what is left? What is left is our ability to respond to the world without greed, hate, and delusion. And the response to the world is just what the system is set up for here. Once we drop greed, hate, and delusion, it's more the surface of the mind, the surface of the heart. And when that surface crust is dissolved, then the depth of who we are has a chance to kind of feel and experience what's happening in this world. And the depth of who we are is a place where we have the opposite of fight and flight. It's where we approach and soothe, where we step forward with care and compassion and kindness and friendliness. And so the absence of self, clinging, allows for that deeper wellspring of attention, of sensitivity, and goodwill to operate. Exactly how it's going to operate for different people is very personal. We should be very careful not to make it any kind of essential idea of what a person should be like when they are free, liberated from self. I think what we're free to do then is for our own deep personality and our uniqueness to come forward and be what it is. And one person might, two people, 10 people, a million people, each of them might have a very different expression of what freedom looks like, or how their deep sensitivity and care for the world gets expressed. And it might be radically different in ways. And so I like the idea that we want to give people who are free the freedom to really be who they are and to trust it, or yourself, who you are. Yeah. Is the arising of self considered within the aggregate of sankhara? Yeah, probably. That's where the mental formations, it's a formations construct in the mind. It wouldn't be anywhere else, that idea, that form. I guess it could be a little bit sanya. It could be part of, you know, recognition of things. How to approach self-loathing with love without engorging the self? Yeah, that's a very good question. And, it's a little bit hard to answer such an important question like that in without more information. But sometimes what helps is to feel the heartbreak of self-loathing, feel the suffering of it and how painful it is to be that way. And sometimes in really feeling the pain of it, something can break. Maybe something, you know, the heart breaks, the broken heart of it. Oh, and only then do we soften and relax when the tears come and we feel, you know, how sad and how difficult that is to live that way. Another way is to begin actually doing the opposite and to offer metta to oneself, loving kindness and compassion, to actually engage in that, both, you know, as a meditation practice, but also with kind acts, to actually live and do things that expresses, or even if you don't feel like you want to be, have self-generosity or self-love, sometimes you can just act your way to it by treating yourself the way and that way and feeling benefits. And then third thing, because it's such an important one, is to talk to people, friends, someone really wise and that you really trust, and just kind of very simply just talk about it, kind of like, maybe it's an unfortunate choice of words, but maybe a little bit like a confession, just a little bit opening up. And sometimes opening up around self-loathing can break the trance. We can hear ourselves speak about it, and we realize, wait a minute, maybe I don't really believe this, or maybe it's not really true, or maybe it kind of breaks out of the shell to talk about it. Because sometimes self-talk is very hard to become free of. The notion that thoughts are not self, I can see not giving them authority, not picking them up, but to disown them as not self, I need help with this. Yes, this is, again, it's so hard with this notion of self and what we're talking about here. But anything that we cling to or hold on to this as the self, at least for that, we understand that clinging to it, the holding on to it, is painful, is not worth doing. And it turns out that if you really focus on the non-clinging aspect, not clinging to self, that most ideas of self that people operate under do in fact have some clinging involved with it. And this shedding of clinging is part of, is part of this freedom we begin discovering for ourselves. And I think that we don't want to disown anything in the sense of we have, to the degree to which we have choice about how to relate to our thoughts and our impulses and our desires, we want to be able to do that wisely. In deep meditation, the choice is to leave them alone. The choice is not to be involved, to let them just be there. And then we can see them as not self. But in ordinary life, we have to actually choose to do things. We don't just leave things alone. And so we have to be, we are responsible for what we think and how we think them and tracking them and questioning them and deciding, how to listen to them in the right way. All this is an important part of who we are. There's no need to disown anything. And that's why it's very, very important not to take this not-self-teaching that's out of its native Buddhist context. And the obvious thing to do, it's so easy for us human beings to do this, is to hear these teachings and then want to apply them outside their context. Well, if this teaching is true, it's such a Buddhist emphasizes so much, then how does it work here and here and here and here? It's not to be applied. Use your common sense in how you live your life. But as we have a deeper and deeper experience of how this revelation, this is not self, this is not self, as that becomes strong in Vipassana practice, some of that then changes our view about how we live our ordinary life. And we start seeing that even our thoughts, there's a way in which they are not self. They arise. So there's no shame or no grandeur for the thoughts that we have. But we still have to be careful about how we pick them up and how we're involved with them. And if we don't automatically attribute them to the self, then sometimes they're less sticky. And if they're less sticky, we have more choice and we can handle them more wisely and good. These mornings are wonderful. So are they not penetrating? Oh, so far they are not penetrating the density of selfing that manifests during the day. Can you speak honestly about what's necessary to actually end our suffering? So the density of selfing that manifests during the day. So if you're motivated to really penetrate the density, the coagulation that we have around self, the attachments to it, it depends, what you've been doing. So this is the whole path of Buddhism, is to really become free of the clinging, including the clinging to self, not to come to a new philosophy of self, but the clinging to self, the attachment to it. And what's left after that, a lot of Buddhists don't want to say that that's self anymore, but they are still very, self-responsible in English language. So, but it's really dense. So the deep meditation practice, that's the Vipassana way. It really, really requires deep, concentrated mindfulness, the kind of mindfulness or attention that's usually for most people only available on retreat, where we really are practicing for a long time. This is where the deep insight of Vipassana, this deep insight into the context for really experiencing this not-self, is most relevant. If a person has done a lot of retreats and feels like they haven't, penetrated that, then they should either talk to a teacher or some teachers and get some advice and ideas, what's going on. Or it might be that there's other modalities that can penetrate through the shell of self that maybe for some people work better than this meditation path. This detachment from self, dispassion, disillusion have negative implications in English. Wish there were a word that imparts the positive nature of these efforts, states, and intentions. Yes, so the word detachment, I think that most Western Dharma teachers who speak English, in Buddhist English, don't use the word detachment very well because of its negative associations, but rather use the word non-attachment. And the idea that that doesn't quite have the same negative kind of distancing or indifference that detachment can suggest. Dispassion. Some people are fine with the word dispassion and disillusion, but I agree that it can have very negative associations for some people. The word passion apparently originally comes from the word suffering, the passion of Christ. So dispassion is to end suffering. In Buddhism, in Buddhist English, dispassion means the absence of very strong craving, like lust. Passion here is not seen as being a zest for life or enthusiasm for life, but rather passion is kind of the passion for, kind of a greed. And disillusion, I think that maybe we should adopt that word more. I don't think that Buddhists use it too much, disillusion. We use the word disenchantment a lot, but they both kind of suggest the idea of not living in illusion, not living in enchantment, and not living in delusion, disillusion. But I think I appreciate this very much, and the idea of positive nature of these efforts, states, and intentions, I think is very good. And, you know, the primary one in Buddhism is freedom, liberation. And sometimes they use the word happiness or great happiness, and sometimes they use the word peace, ease, to live with ease, to live with peace that doesn't have the agitation that comes with attachment, the agitation that comes with craving, the agitation that comes from living in illusion or delusion. Yeah, it's a very good point. Where do thoughts come from? Well, where do thoughts come from? Thoughts arise from the combined, interrelated functioning of the whole planet. Everything contributes to the rising of a thought. And I say that in that kind of, you know, kind of a little bit phantasmagoric way, is that it's fascinating, the birth of a thought, and if the mind is really quiet and really still, to see a thought arise, and not see it coming, it just suddenly arise without any. Sometimes we see that thoughts arise clearly because of something prompts the thought, and we can see, oh, I thought X because someone told me about Y, and I was reminded of something, or if I say the phrase, the hills are alive with the sound of, many people of a certain age would fill in those lyrics of a song, and the thought music would appear. And so where did that come from? Well, it was kind of like prompted by my silly example. So you can sometimes kind of see the cause and conditions that precede the birth of a thought. But sometimes it just arises kind of completely without any seeming cause and conditions. And what is the combined forces and conditions that allow the thought to arise? It's fascinating. And but what's more fascinating is it's hard to take that thought as this is myself. The thought music, if some of you know the lyrics of that song, then was that word music appearing in your mind? Is that you? Were you that? Is that really who you are? Or did you have a choice in that word appearing? And did you plan it? And, you know, is it any different than the breeze of being felt across your skin? That, some parts of the mind just operate without really kind of an automatic. So these are fascinating questions self, the birth of thoughts. And the idea in doing Buddhist practice, when we really get into the flow of it, is not to get distracted by questions like that, because the task is to really have very clear mindfulness about what's actually happening in the moment as we're experiencing it, so that we come to this place of freedom. So I hope these answers are good. I hope this has been interesting, and I appreciate all the questions. They are, it shows me how important it is to have an exchange. It's a little bit limitation of this YouTube, or big limitation of this YouTube time and world that we have to live with a little bit. And I hope that I look forward to the time that we can be more in person and also have more dialogue. So thank you, and I'll see you in a few weeks, or maybe Sunday if some of you come there.